being afraid all the time.
That's true. I don't.
Valentine's voice was as sorrowful as his eyes, as if he pitied Hodge. But there was dislike in his eyes, too, a trace of scorn.
If you did not intend to give the cup to me, he said, you should not have summoned me here.
Hodge's face worked.
It is not easy to betray what you believe in, those who trust you.
Do you mean the Lightwoods or their children?
Both, said Hodge.
Ah, the Lightwoods.
Valentine reached out and with a hand caressed the brass globe that stood on the desk, his long fingers tracing the outlines of continents and seas.
But what do you owe them, really? Yours is the punishment that should have been theirs. If they had not had such high connections in the Clave, they would have been cursed along with you. As it is, they are free to come and go, to walk in the sunlight like ordinary men. They are free to go home.
His voice, as he said home, thrilled with all the meaning of the word. His finger had stopped moving over the globe. Clary was sure he was touching the place where Idris would be. Hodge's eyes darted away.
They did what anyone would do.
You would not have done it. I would not have done it. To let a friend suffer in my place. And surely it must engender some bitterness in you, Starkweather, to know that they so easily left this fate to you.
Hodge's shoulders shook.
But it is not the children's fault. They have done nothing.
I never knew you to be so fond of children, Starkweather,
Valentine said, as if the idea entertained him. The breath rattled in Hodge's chest.
Jace! You will not speak of Jace!
For the first time, Valentine sounded angry. He glanced at the still figure on the floor.
He is bleeding, he observed.
Why?
Hodge held the cup against his heart. His knuckles were white.
It's not his blood. He's unconscious, but not injured.
Valentine raised his head with a pleasant smile.
I wonder, he said, what he will think of you when he wakes. Betrayal is never pretty, but to betray a child, that's a double betrayal, don't you think?
You won't hurt him, whispered Hodge. You swore you wouldn't hurt him.
I never did that, said Valentine. Come now.
He moved away from the desk toward Hodge, who flinched away like a small trapped animal. Clary could see his misery.
And what would you do if I said I did plan to hurt him? Would you fight me? Keep the cup from me? Even if you could kill me, the Clave will never lift your curse. You'll hide here till you die, terrified to do so much as open a window too widely. What wouldn't you trade away, not to be afraid any longer? What wouldn't you give up, to go home again?
Clary tore her eyes away. She could no longer bear the look on Hodge's face. In a choked voice, he said,
Tell me you won't hurt him, and I'll give it to you.
No, said Valentine, even more softly. You will give it to me anyway.
And he reached out his hand. Hodge closed his eyes. For a moment, his face was the face of one of the marble angels beneath the desk, pained and grave and crushed beneath a terrible weight. Then he swore pathetically under his breath and held the mortal cup out for Valentine to take, though his hand shook like a leaf in a high wind.
Thank you, said Valentine.
He took the cup and eyed it thoughtfully.
I do believe you've dented the rim.
Hodge said nothing. His face was gray. Valentine bent down and gathered up Jace. As he lifted him up lightly, Clary saw the impeccably cut jacket tighten over his arms and back, and she realized that he was a deceptively massive man, with a torso like the trunk of an oak tree. Jace, limp in his arms, looked like a child by comparison.
He'll be with his father soon, said Valentine,
looking down at Jace's white face.
Where he belongs.
Hodge flinched. Valentine turned away from him and walked back toward the shimmering curtain of air that he had come through. He must have left the portal door open behind him, Clary realized. Looking at it was like looking at sunlight bouncing off the surface of a mirror. Hodge reached out an imploring hand.
Wait, he cried. What of your promise to me? You swore to end my curse.
That is true, said Valentine.
He paused and looked hard at Hodge, who gasped and stepped back, his hand flying to his chest as if something had struck him in the heart. Black fluid seeped out around his splayed fingers and trickled to the floor. Hodge lifted his scarred face to Valentine.
Is it done?
He asked wildly.
The curse! Is it lifted?
Yes, said Valentine. And may your bought freedom bring you joy.
And with that, he stepped through the curtain of glowing air. For a moment, he himself seemed to shimmer, as if he stood underwater. Then he vanished, taking Jace with him. Chapter 20. In Wrath's Alley. Hodge, gasping, stared after him, his fists clenching and unclenching at his sides. His left hand was gloved with the wet dark fluid that had seeped from his chest. The look on his face was a mixture of exultation and self-loathing.
Hodge!
Clary slammed her hand into the invisible wall between them. Pain shot up her arm, but it was nothing compared to the searing pain inside her chest. She felt as if her heart were going to slam its way out of her ribcage. Jace, Jace, Jace! The words echoed in her mind, wanting to be screamed out loud. She bit them back.
Hodge, let me out!
Hodge turned, shaking his head.
I can't, he said,
using his immaculately folded handkerchief to rub at his stained hand. He sounded genuinely regretful.
You'll only try to kill me.
I won't, she said, I promise.
But you were not raised a shadow hunter, he said, and your promises mean nothing.
The edge of his handkerchief was smoking now, as if he dipped it in acid, and his hand was no less blackened. Frowning, he abandoned the project.
But Hodge, she said desperately, didn't you hear him? He's going to kill Jace.
He didn't say that.
Hodge was at the desk now, opening a drawer, taking out a piece of paper. He drew a pen from his pocket, tapping it sharply against the edge of the desk to make the ink flow. Clary stared at him. Was he writing a letter?
Hodge, she said carefully. Valentine said Jace would be with his father soon. Jace's father is dead. What else could he have meant?
Hodge didn't look up from the paper he was scribbling on.
It's complicated. You wouldn't understand.
I understand enough.
Her bitterness felt like it might burn through her tongue.
I understand that Jace trusted you and you traded him away to a man who hated his father and probably hates Jace too, just because you're too cowardly to live with a curse you deserved.
Hodge's head jerked up.
Is that what you think?
It's what I know.
He laid his pen down, shaking his head. He looked tired and so old, so much older than Valentine had looked, though they were the same age.
You only know bits and fragments, Clary, and you're better off that way.
He folded the piece of paper he'd been writing on into a neat square and tossed it into the fire, which flared up a bright acidic green before subsiding.
What are you doing? Clary demanded.
Sending a message.
Hodge turned away from the fire. He was standing close to her, separated only by the invisible wall. She pressed her fingers against it, wishing she could dig them into his eyes, though they were as sad as Valentine's had been angry.
You are young, he said. The past is nothing to you, not even another country as it is to the old, or a nightmare as it is to the guilty. The Clave laid this curse on me because I aided Valentine. But I was hardly the only member of the Circle to serve him. Were the Lightwoods not as guilty as I was? Were not the Waylands? Yet I was the only one cursed to live out my life without being able to set so much as a foot outdoors, not so much as a hand through the window.
That's not my fault, said Clary. It's not Jace's fault. Why punish him for what the Clave did? I can understand giving Valentine the cup, but Jace?
He'll kill Jace just like he killed Jace's father.
Valentine, said Hodge, did not kill Jace's father.
A sob broke free from Clary's chest. I don't believe you. All you do is tell lies. Everything you've ever said was a lie.
Ah, he said, the moral absolutism of the young, which allows for no concessions. Can't you see, Clary, that in my own way I'm trying to be a good man?
She shook her head. It doesn't work that way. The good things you do don't cancel out the bad ones. But, she bit her lip, if you told me where Valentine was...
No,
he breathed the word.
It is said that the Nephilim are the children of men and angels. All that this angelic heritage has given to us is a longer distance to fall.
He touched the invisible surface of the wall with his fingertips.
You were not raised as one of us. You have no part of this life of scars and killing. You can still get away. Leave the Institute, Clary, as soon as you can. Leave and never come back.
She shook her head.
I can't, she said. I can't do that. Then you have my condolences, he said, and walked out of the room.
The door closed behind Hodge, leaving Clary in silence. There was only her own harsh breathing and the scrabble of her fingertips against the ungiving, transparent barrier between her and the door. She did exactly what she told herself she wouldn't do, and flung herself against it, again and again, until she was exhausted and her sides ached. Then she sank to the floor and tried not to cry. Somewhere on the other side of this barrier, Alec was dying, while Isabel waited for Hodge to come and save him. Somewhere beyond this room, Jace was being shaken roughly awake by Valentine. Somewhere, her mother's chances were ebbing away, moment by moment, second by second. And she was trapped here, as useless and helpless as the child she was. She sat bolt upright then, remembering the moment at Madame Dorothea's when Jace had pressed the steely into her hand. Had she ever given it back to him? Holding her breath, she felt in her left jacket pocket. It was empty. Slowly, her hand crept into the right pocket, her sweaty fingers picking up lint and then skidding across something hard, smooth, and round. The steely. She bounded to her feet, her heart pounding, and felt with her left hand for the invisible wall. Finding it, she braced herself, inching the tip of the steely forward with her other hand until it rested against the smooth, level air. Already an image was forming in her mind, like a fish rising up through cloudy water, the pattern of its scales growing clearer and clearer as it neared the surface. Slowly at first, and then more confidently, she moved the steely across the wall, leaving searingly bright ash-white lines hovering in the air before her. She felt when the rune was done, and lowered her hand, breathing hard. For a moment, everything was motionless and silent, and the rune hung like glowing neon, burning her eyes. Then came a sound like the loudest shattering she had ever heard, as if she were standing under a waterfall of stones, listening to them crash to the ground all around her. The rune she had drawn turned black and sifted away like ash. The floor trembled under her feet. Then it was over, and she knew, without a doubt, that she was free. Still holding the steely, she raced to the window and pushed the curtain aside. Twilight was falling, and the streets below were bathed in a reddish-purple glow. She caught a clear glimpse of Hodge crossing a street, his gray head bobbing above the crowd. She dashed out of the library and down the stairs, pausing only to shove the steely back into her jacket pocket. She took the stairs running and hit the street with a stitch already forming in her side. People walking their dogs in the humid twilight jumped aside as she barreled down the walkway alongside the East River. She caught sight of herself in the darkened window of an apartment building as she careened around a corner. Her sweaty hair was plastered to her forehead, her face crusted with dried blood. She reached the intersection where she had seen Hodge. For a moment, she thought she'd lost him. She darted through the crowd near the subway entrance, shouldering people aside, using her knees and elbows as weapons. Sweaty and bruised, Clary pulled free of the crowd just in time to see a flash of tweed suit disappear around the corner of a narrow service alley between two buildings. She wriggled around a dumpster and into the mouth of the alley. The back of her throat felt like it was burning every time she breathed. Though it had been twilight on the street, here in the alley it was as dark as nightfall. She could just see Hodge, standing at the far end of the alley, where it dead-ended into the back of a fast-food restaurant. Restaurant trash was piled outside, heaping bags of food, dirty paper plates, and plastic cutlery that crunched unpleasantly under his boots as he turned to look at her. She remembered a poem she'd read in English class. "I think we are in Rat's Alley, where the dead men lost their bones."
"You followed me," he said. "You shouldn't have."
"I'll leave you alone if you just tell me where Valentine is."
"I can't do that," he said. "He'll know I told you, and my freedom will be as short as my life."
"It will be anyway when the Clave finds out that you gave the mortal cup to Valentine," Clary pointed out, "after tricking us into finding it for you. How can you live with yourself, knowing what he plans to do with it?" He cut her off with a short laugh.
"I fear Valentine more than the Clave, and so would you if you were wise," he said. "He would have found the cup eventually, whether I helped him or not."
"And you don't care that he's going to use it to kill children?" A spasm crossed his face. As he took a step forward, she saw something shine in his hand.
"Does all this really matter to you this much?"
"I told you before," she said. "I can't just walk away."
"That's too bad," he said,
and she saw him raise his arm and remembered suddenly Jace saying that Hodge's weapon had been the chakram, the flying disc. She ducked even before she saw the bright circle of metal spin singing toward her head. It passed, humming, inches from her face and embedded itself in the metal fire escape on her left. She looked up. Hodge was gazing at her, the second metal disc held lightly in his right hand.
"You can still run," he said.
Instinctively, she raised her hands, though logic told her the chakram would just slice them to pieces.
"Hodge!"
Something hurtled in front of her, something big, gray-black, and alive. She heard Hodge shout in horror. Stumbling backward, Clary saw the thing more clearly as it paced between her and Hodge. It was a wolf, 6 feet in length, with a jet-black coat shot through with a single stripe of gray. Hodge, the metal disc gripped in his hand, was white as a bone.
"You," he breathed,
and with a sense of distant astonishment, Clary realized he was talking to the wolf.
"I thought that you had fled."
The wolf's lips drew back from its teeth, and she saw its lolling red tongue. There was hatred in its eyes as it looked at Hodge, a pure and human hatred.
"Did you come for me or for the girl?" said Hodge.
Sweat streamed from his temples, but his hand was steady. The wolf paced toward him, growling low in its throat.
"There's still time," said Hodge. "Valentine would take you back."
With a howl, the wolf sprang. Hodge cried out again, then there was a flash of silver, and a sickening noise as the chakram embedded itself in the wolf's side. The wolf reared back on its hind legs, and Clary saw the disc's edge jutting from the wolf's fur, blood streaming just as it struck Hodge. Hodge screamed once as he went down, the wolf's jaws clamping shut over his shoulder. Blood flew into the air like the spray of paint from a broken can, splattering the cement wall with red. The wolf lifted its head from the tutor's limp body and turned its gray, lupine gaze on Clary, teeth dripping scarlet. She didn't scream. There was no air in her lungs that she could have dragged up to make a sound. She scrambled to her feet and ran for the mouth of the alley and the familiar neon lights of the street, ran for the safety of the real world. She could hear the wolf growling behind her, feel its hot breath on the bare backs of her legs. She put on one last burst of speed, flinging herself toward the street. The wolf's jaws closed on her leg, jerking her backward. Just before her head struck the hard pavement, plunging her into blackness, she discovered that she did have enough air to scream after all. The sound of dripping water woke her. Slowly, Clary peeled her eyes open. There wasn't much to see. She lay on a wide cot that had been placed on the floor of a small, dingy walled room. There was a rickety table propped against one wall. On it was a cheap-looking brass candle holder, sporting a fat red candle that cast the only light in the room. The ceiling was cracked and damp, wetness seeping down through the fissures in the stone. Clary felt a vague sense that something was missing from the room, but this concern was overwhelmed by the strong smell of wet dog. She sat up and immediately wished she hadn't. Hot pain drove through her head like a spike, followed by a racking wave of nausea. If there had been anything in her stomach, she would have thrown it up. A mirror hung over the cot, dangling from a nail driven between two stones. She glanced in it and was appalled. No wonder her face hurt. Long parallel scratches ran from the corner of her right eye down to the edge of her